But we got no particular answer. And sometimes it seemed to us, as I compared notes with Bill afterwards, that the assistant minister revised the remarks of this former North Vietnamese captain before they were translated by the interpreter. Sitting around the coffee table with us was the director of the camp, who himself is a returnee. He has never been a soldier. He was a professor of philosophy at Hanoi University. And I tried to raise some questions about the teaching of philosophy and about his possible work or reading in philosophy at present. He said that people in Hanoi, in the university, read any philosophy they cared to, but the official doctrine was and had to be dialectical materialism. Later in the yard, we met a short, rather plump Vietnamese, whom we were told is a well-known writer from North Vietnam, a novelist, who has defected and come over to the Chieu Hoi program and is at present writing a novel about this experience. He is assistant director of the camp. As we walked about and saw the returnees sitting on their bunks in typical army barracks dormitories, they seemed really rather sad and listless. We were told that they were given furloughs into Saigon and that their stays in the Chieu Hoi camps would not in any case be long, not longer than 2 months normally. And they were simply waiting. Well, perhaps that was the main atmosphere of the place. These people were waiting to get out and to get into South Vietnam and stop being problems or considering themselves as problems. Bill and I talked about the strange fact that no one, to our knowledge, has written the sort of book that Mary McCarthy has written in favor of the other side. No one has gone around seeing the things we've been seeing, talking to the people we've been talking, and writing a book that indicates that there are positive programs conducted by the South Vietnamese government, that there are promising things looking toward a better future, and that not all is dismal and evil on the southern side. One could indeed, it occurred to me, start a book with the precise remark that Mary McCarthy uses, but put it in reverse, saying that one had come to South Vietnam determined to find things that were good. They're here to be found. How strange it is that no one, no journalists, no writers at all, have tried to find them or tried to write about them. They may not be the whole story at all, but all the same, the things we have been seeing are real. And the picture is misrepresented when these things, these positive things, are neglected. An interesting particular point is that the largest number of defectors from the BC and the NBA came in 1969. This would argue that the failure of the Tet Offensive and the expectation of a negotiated peace caused the largest number to come over. On the other hand, however, the further expectation of peace in 1972 seems to have had little effect. The smallest number of defectors since the Chiu Hoi program was initiated in 1963. There is, of course, one overarching question that remains. Why does the BC, or rather mostly now the NBA, control such large parts of South Vietnamese territory? The Chiu Hoi program seems very unsuccessful in the face of this great fact of the current situation. This afternoon, Bill and I visited the rector of Van Han University, the only Buddhist university in Vietnam, in quite a new institution, which the rector, the venerable Thich Van Chao, has built up in just a few years to a student body of 4,000. He was in his saffron robe and with his round face and rather roly-poly figure and smiling easy way seemed like a Buddha himself. He told us that the students mostly study non-Buddhistic subjects, the usual liberal arts sort of menu, but he has some Buddhist monks in training. And for them, Buddhist studies are provided. We noticed one woman in Buddhist robes, apparently studying in the same way. He told us also that the students are inclined to care for nothing but pleasure and to be somewhat rebellious. I'm not sure that this was more important than the usual deploring of the frivolity of the younger generations by the older people that can be found anywhere, anytime. The students in the library and elsewhere seemed thoroughly normal, much like students anywhere. The library was pitiably small. The classrooms were remarkably large. We were shown as if with pride by Thich Van Chao a classroom that not only held 1,000 seats inside its four walls, but also had an extension with closed-circuit television provide seats for 500 more students to hear the same lecture in another room. The tuition for the students is about $30 a year. And we were told by Mrs. Zung that this is high and difficult for all but the more well-to-do families to manage for their children. The topmost floor of the main building is mostly open to the sky, and there was an effort to produce a roof garden, which Thich Van Chao declared was in the Japanese style, although I didn't notice that. He apologized for the lack of water, which accounted for the quite dim performance of the various plants. Then, in a kind of penthouse, there was the main meditation room for the Buddhists. It was an empty sort of room with a very poor plaster image of the Buddha, very poor sorts of vases, a drum or so, a few cushions, and about as uninspiring a place for meditation as one could easily imagine. And yet it was no uglier than many a Roman Catholic chapel in a Roman Catholic university that I have seen in the United States. So there it was, a Buddhist university built up from scratch under war conditions by this quite remarkable, very pleasing man. Evidence that Buddhism is more than tolerated in this country, even though our press has told us nothing about Buddhism since the political Buddhists had their tragic run-in with President Diem in 1962 and 63. Then Bill and I went to Saigon University and talked to the assistant to the president. He was actually assistant for administration, a very keen businessman, not much in the way of an educator. He made a sharp remark, however, in response to my indication that I'm interested in getting in touch with Vietnamese historians who are interested in the recent period. He said that they have some professors of history, but he doubts that they have any historians. Saigon University is the main public institution of the Republic of Vietnam. We were told that students are permitted to meet for social and cultural purposes on the university campus, but they are not permitted to meet together alone in student groups for political purposes. He said they probably meet outside the campus and discuss political questions. I should have mentioned that before we left the Van Han University, that is the Buddhist institution we visited first this afternoon, the venerable Thich Minh Chao presented to us copies of an impressive-looking scholarly publication, a publication of the Van Han University, on the life and work of Thera, a leading disciple of the Buddha. I took the book as a work by the rector
but this evening on examining it, I found that the rector merely wrote a preface for the book, and just who the author, whose name is Thich Hien V, or in parentheses, Le Van Hien, who wrote the book in India, just who he may be and how he's connected with this university, I don't know. Neither of these institutions is an attractive place physically. The buildings are sad. The plaster is patched, and there's a general air of decrepitude around even the newer buildings. The whole idea of a campus, as we think of it in the United States, as an idealistic park sort of place, a little educational utopia for the faculty and the students' benefit, is just non-existent here. The climate is one thing. The buildings are those that one finds in the tropics. And the colonial background of the country is another thing. The buildings are thinned down versions of what one might find in France. All the same, higher education in Vietnam is booming. And one thinks about how, in these moments, which may turn out to be the very last moments of the generation-long war that this country has suffered, that in these moments there is a strong thrust forward that's visible in many areas, and appropriately in education, higher education too. Considering the energy and dedication that are going into the building up of this country, even while the war continues, one comes to believe that the country could have a future as a sort of Denmark of Southeast Asia, if just the communists would leave it alone and the Americans would go home. Not that the Americans or the communists would have to stay away forever. One of the amazing things that one observes is the posters of the National Tourist Office, which present places like Dalat and Hue as glamorous targets of touristic activity, and make one think that with half a chance, this country could fall into the normal ways of peacetime life and agreeable ways of travel, instead of the semi-military travel that Bill and I are going to undertake by helicopter tomorrow. That remark was a mistake. Tomorrow, that is Wednesday, I'm speaking on Wednesday now, was not helicopter day, but Navy day, as I explain presently. We're going to go to Anlok helicopter tomorrow, Thursday, my life actually.
So much better than it was before. I can't repay her, but I can tell her I love you. Today was Navy Day. This is
This is Wednesday, January 10th. It was Navy Day. We had a remarkable view of the Vietnamese Navy and the progress it has made in building itself up from zero just a few years ago to the eighth Navy in the world today. Naval operations. And he was a very genial person who presented us with engraved plaques and discussed the situation of the Vietnamese Navy with, it seemed to us, remarkable frankness. Then we went into his chart room, and his aide, a captain in the Navy, gave us an hour-long briefing. The main point is that the coastal defense of South Vietnam is entirely in the hands of the South Vietnamese Navy. It carries on without Americans doing more than standing by. They don't exactly advise anymore. As one of the American naval officers explained to me later, they stand apart and observe, and they will speak up if they're asked, but almost never otherwise. Apparently, the big changeover of warships and of bases from American ownership into Vietnamese naval hands occurred about 2 years ago. Now we saw a cutter, which apparently is the chief coastal defense ship, chief type. The admiral wants more cutters, but as Bill said to him, he has never heard of an admiral who doesn't want more ships. The riverine navy has the special job of keeping open the channel to Saigon. That channel has been dredged since the American escalation began, and ocean-going ships come up here into the basin in front of this hotel and a little beyond. So it's very important from a military point of view to keep open the channel, and apparently a belt of some width in the delta lands on both sides of the Saigon River are kept quite clean of VC and NVNA. In the afternoon, we visited a shipyard where the most impressive thing we saw was the construction of what looked like rather large patrol boats out of concrete. We saw various of these boats in various stages of construction, from chicken wire forms to finished boats, 2 inches thick, compressed concrete. They're apparently very successful. This is one of the important examples of the Vietnamese themselves not merely maintaining ships given to them by the United States, but building their own ships. Then we drove down to a logistics base south of Saigon, where headquarters of the Riverine Navy is found. And we received another briefing there, showing the various problems of the mission of that base. Then we were taken aboard a gunship and went south on the river for some miles and observed a demonstration of a landing operation. A large warship, large for the river, first fired 40-millimeter guns that looked remarkably like the Bofors anti-aircraft guns that I saw in the Second World War, fired them ashore with a remarkable effect of fireworks. Helicopters accompanied our small flotilla south along the river, sweeping along both sides. Then they let loose, these helicopters let loose, missiles which shot down into the delta land at the supposed target with tremendous effect. And finally, along came the landing craft with Vietnamese soldiers piling out onto the bank and working their way through the tall grass growth ashore and toward the objective, which had been softened up by the air and warship shelling. It was quite a demonstration. We were rather astonished. We hoped that the little riverine flotilla needed exercise and didn't merely put on the show for our amusement. Now, the situation is really very strange when one reflects upon it. The South Vietnamese control the river. They control a belt of land on both banks. They control the roads, although it's true that we were given a jeep with a machine gun mounted on it to protect us as we drove south. South Vietnamese certainly control the air. And in spite of all this, it's still true that VC and NVNA, in some combination that's not at all clear to me, still lurk in the Delta lands. They are able to make many villages unsafe, I gathered from hints here and there along the way. They are unable to attack strong points, cities, and so forth. But on the other hand, the South Vietnamese are apparently unable, and the Americans with the South Vietnamese in former years have been unable to dislodge these guerrillas from the backcountry in the deltas. I gather that this situation has been stalemated like this for quite a long time. Now, if a ceasefire in place occurs, which seems to be the kind of ceasefire that we'll have, if we have any at all, it's just very hard to imagine how this will work with leopard spots of guerrillas all over these delta lands, the more remote areas away from streams, and with South Vietnam controlling the streams themselves and the air above the whole territory. Whether there can be some sort of freezing of this situation seems impossible, but I'm just guessing about it. I'm just wondering and astonished at the strange inability of either side to make a decisive move in a military sense. It was borne home to us today when we saw how close to the road and close to the river the danger of VC power remains. We were told that there is trouble wherever tributary streams flow into the larger ones in this vast, complicated delta area. The Americans, of course, were always handicapped because they couldn't possibly melt into the population as the VC and NVNA can. Now that the South Vietnamese are being so greatly strengthened, as it seems to us, it's possible to imagine an outcome, which would run something like this, that after they have fully established their control over the main arteries,